Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. Today on the show, I'm so excited to have Chris Mills, technical writer on the Mozilla Developer Network Writers Team, which people might know better as MDN. Chris, you want to say hi?
Hi, Saran. Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So Rachel Neighbors, who we had on episode 6, oh man, that was over a year ago. She introduced us via email back a few months ago, I think it was. And we finally made this interview happen. I'm so excited to have you on.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here too.
So technical writing is a topic that I don't think we've covered yet on this podcast. I think a lot of people who may come from writing and storytelling and content creation will appreciate what you get to do with kind of merging that writing with the software coding technical world. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about Mozilla versus the Mozilla Developer Network. What's the difference there?
Well, so Mozilla is, you know, the company that makes Firefox and all of the other products that we throw out there, whereas the Mozilla Developer Network is basically our documentation super site. It's the huge, great mass of documentation that we have covering everything from standard web platform features to proprietary API features that feature in products such as Firefox OS and our web extensions frameworks and things such as that. And it also covers things such as installing products, you know, so installing the Firefox browser and building your own version of the Firefox browser and how to contribute features back to that project and things such as that. So it's quite a wide variety of stuff on there.
Very nice. So is MDN part of Mozilla? Is it like its own foundation, or what's the relationship?
It's part of the Mozilla Corporation. So we have the Mozilla Corporation and the Mozilla Foundation. The Mozilla Corporation is the part of Mozilla that makes all the products and does all the deals and all of that kind of stuff, whereas the Foundation is the part that does things like charitable work and educational initiatives and fundraising and advocacy and other such things.
Cool. So let's get into technical writing. What does that mean?
So I like to think of technical writing as being a conduit between the engineers that build all of the complicated stuff and the people who actually want to use that stuff. You know, you're acting as a conduit to actually take all of this amazing, complicated tech and make it understanding and seamless for people to actually make use of via good quality communication. I like to say communication as opposed to just documentation because, you know, technical writers do a lot of documentation, but we also do quite a lot of talks and video tutorials and other such things. So
as a technical writer, what kinds of things do you think about to make sure that what you're writing is helpful to other people?
So there's a lot of things to consider, really. The first thing that I always go for when I'm trying to document a particular technology or feature is I always think of the target audience I'm going for. So, you know, if it's something like building a piece of desktop software for really, really advanced level people who already know that kind of stuff, you want to assume that they know all of the basic stuff, such as installing Clang and things like that, and just go on to the actual build steps and perhaps a bit of troubleshooting for anything that's unusual that they don't already know about. Whereas if you're doing something like a complete beginner's tutorial to web development, which we're going to be talking about some of that stuff later on, you really need to not assume anything. So one problem tends to be that if you have an article where you want a clear focus on something like an introduction to HTML, say, you don't want to kind of double the length of the article by constantly having loads of definitions cluttered up everywhere. So the way that we deal with that on MDN is that we have a great big glossary that we can link to whenever we need to explain a term. So that's kind of useful. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it really is just making sure that you have a decent, clear writing style, but also like a recognizable format so that people who have used your documentation before will already be comfortable with how you lay things out and will kind of have a sort of a step up already kind of thing. So we have on MDN, we have clear templates that we use to write all of our documentation for, like, for example, API references. So, you know, if you've seen one, then you've seen them all, so that you'll basically know how to find the details you need really quickly.
I think that point is really important, because when we think of good writing for personal stories, novels, you know, just blog posts, we think of it as, oh, there has to be a twist, there has to be a buildup and a resolution. And, you know, there's kind of these things where we want to constantly keep our readers on their toes. And technical writing sounds like it's kind of the opposite of that in a way, right? You want to be predictable, because the goal is to get them the information as quickly as you can and to make coding and working in projects a lot easier for them.
I think that's a very interesting point to consider, actually. I mean, I see it as more of a balance. It really depends on the kind of style of stuff you're writing. So when you're just writing pure technical reference material, you want to have it as dry and as uncluttered as possible. But I think when you're writing something like a tutorial, you want to have a little bit more verbiage in there and a little bit more excitement, because when tutorials are too dry, they just become really boring to follow. So it actually starts to hinder the learning experience. But if you can just have a little bit of fun in there, you know, maybe the odd little bit of humor in places, and especially amusing examples, you know, that kind of thing helps people to A, have a bit more fun while they're actually going through and doing their learning. But it also makes them remember it afterwards too. You know, you think to yourself, you know, you're much more likely to remember that tutorial about CSS with the really funny example than just some random boring CSS tutorial. But you mustn't go too far. That's the only problem. It's like, you know, when you have too much humor and silliness and it starts to get in the way of the learning again, then you've gone too far. So
do you feel like how much humor and funniness you put in is correlated to the difficulty level? Like, I'm wondering if for a beginner, maybe you need a little bit more of that to make it a little less intimidating and more relatable, but then for a more advanced tutorial, you might want to just kind of get to the point.
I don't know. I mean, I've not really thought about that so much. I think I pretty much put a similar amount of humor type stuff and lighthearted stuff in regardless of a difficulty level. I think what's probably more important is kind of how comfortable and at ease you make the reader feel. So I tend to use a style that is relatively well known in the technical publishing world. It's called peer-to-peer. So the idea being that you need to write it with a style that makes it sound like you're a friend or an immediate peer of the person who's trying to learn, sat next to them going, hey, you know, I'm going to help you learn this. Almost like, you know, like a friend down the local bar or something, you know, rather than I'm a teacher and you're the student, I'm standing here imposing myself over you and making you feel intimidated and small kind of thing. That's something that I try to keep closely to my heart whenever I write anything to teach people.
One of the things you talked about is knowing who your audience is, right? And if it's a beginner, maybe you'll do things a little bit differently. For someone advanced, you might choose a different, you know, style or technique. I'm wondering, how do you define a beginner? How do you define someone who's more advanced? And this is kind of a bigger question in our industry, because I know lots of developers who've been coding for, you know, 2-3 years who have senior level positions, and developers who've been coding for 5 years and still feel very junior and still feel very beginner. So as a writer, how do you think about those different levels?
So there's definitely a few different levels of beginner. You know, for example, on the MDN learning area, which we're going to talk about more in a little while, I generally assume that people have basic computer literacy. They probably know how to do things like creating a new file and changing the file extension to HTML. They just haven't learned any of the actual code syntax yet that they're going to learn on the journey. Whereas I also have a complete beginner's guide to getting started, which assumes that they don't even know things like dealing with files. You know, it's like, I think it's worth including, like, here's your beginner's level stuff, but here's an even more basic level thing. Just in case you hadn't even got to those bits yet, just to make sure that kind of hopefully, regardless of the level of the person coming into your class or whatever you're doing, they don't feel too intimidated, because it's those kind of simple things that can just leave people feeling really helpless really quickly. It's like, for example, whenever I teach a workshop for complete beginners, I always tend to try and use an online GUI tool like Mozilla Thimble or JS Bin or CodePen or something like that to write code down in, because for a bunch of complete beginners, you can literally lose like an entire morning trying to explain to them how to create a new file, how to make your CSS apply to your HTML, etc., etc. So if we come on to more advanced people, then there's definitely different levels of advance too. So you think to yourself, you know, you're talking about the kind of coders who have done maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years coding, but still consider themselves fairly junior. I think it's really, it's not necessarily a matter of being able to do the job, but it's just a matter of kind of how much experience you've got and how quickly you can, you know, pull some magic out of the hat. So for example, you know, you might consider yourself pretty competent in HTML or CSS, in which case I can give you a tutorial that will assume all of that stuff, but will assume you know absolutely nothing about, you know, a new CSS3 feature that's just come out that I want to teach you about, or maybe a new HTML5 element that does something interesting. Whereas when you start to get kind of more experienced and more senior, you can kind of assume that the people are going to be able to look up the information a bit more themselves. So you can just have less explanation and just think to yourself, well, you know, there's an acronym there that they probably won't know, but they can just go and look that up in a search engine.
Interesting. It sounds to me one of the things that is associated with those levels is kind of confidence to figure it out on your own versus maybe needing a little bit more handholding.
Yep. I think that's absolutely an important thing. You know, it's whenever I teach my beginners workshops and things, people always say to me things like, you know, what's the most important skill you can possibly learn to work in the tech industry? And I just say, well, the most important skill you can have is just the ability to look up and learn new things quickly. You know, yes. aside from any specific tech or anything like that, because that kind of stuff is constantly going to change. But the thing that remains the same is just sort of passion and problem solving and research skills and things like that.
Yep, technology is always changing, so you got to be able to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
How do you decide what topics to write about?
Generally, the topics that I have to write about for MDN are usually things that the engineers have just implemented in Firefox that I have to make sure are covered. You know, like I do quite a lot of technical writing of different new APIs, making sure that there's API references available for new things and tutorials to teach people the basics. So the whole of Mozilla and everything we do is done inside our Bugzilla install. And, you know, there's about 1.2 or 1.3 million bugs on that thing now.
Wow.
And that covers literally, you know, everything from coding Firefox to building the Firefox dev tools to legal to accounts. You know, pretty much everything's done inside Bugzilla. It's kind of funny. So the way that we keep on track of everything is we have a system called dev.needed. So it's well known amongst Mozilla engineers that whenever you've just coded some kind of feature on Firefox or whatever that probably needs some documentation written about it, if you add the dev.needed keyword to your bug, it means that our tools will then pick that up and give us a list of things that need to be covered. So that's how we sort of keep in contact with a lot of the teams that we do work with. And you know, quite often we have kind of slightly more tangible relationships than that. But, you know, that's kind of the very least we have in terms of the contact with the different engineering teams. And then there's sometimes kind of special projects that we get called to work on outside the new features in the browser as well. So the learning area that we're going to talk about is definitely one of those. You know, like pretty much my strongest skill and the sort of the thing that I have most experience in is writing beginners tutorials. So I was an obvious fit to write the learners material for MDN.
Yeah, so let's talk about learning area. Sure. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, we were looking at the position that MDN has in the tech community. And we kind of thought, well, you know, amongst the web development community, it's a really well-respected site. You know, people use it all the time for JavaScript reference documentation and HTML and CSS reference documentation and for learning things about Mozilla-specific technologies and things like that. But we kind of thought, well, it's a site which is very much loved and used daily by intermediate to advanced web developers, but it's not the friendliest site in the world if you're a complete beginner. You know, it's like a lot of people, you know, absolutely love to poke fun at sites like W3 Schools. But at the end of the day, it's a fairly welcoming site to beginners. You know, a lot of beginners will want to learn just by grabbing a quick code example, pasting it into their code editor and just having a little bit of a fiddle around with it. Whereas you come onto the average MDN reference page and it'll say, you know, it greets you up front with things like, here's the initial value of the CSS property. Here's the computed value. Here's all of these really, really interesting arcane things that you may want to know at some point, but as a beginner, it will probably make you run away screaming. So we kind of thought, well, how can we get around this? You know, we have a whole bunch of tutorials and we do have quite a lot of existing beginner's material, but it's kind of not organized as well as it could be. So we thought, well, let's get all of the beginner's stuff organized under one solid section of the site. With the intention of making MDN more friendly to beginners. And I think it started to work fairly well. You know, the idea is that, you know, you think to yourself, well, I found the CSS reference, but I don't know that much about CSS yet. But then we're going to start including links from the reference material to say, you know, if you don't already know CSS, go over here and learn it and then come back kind of thing. You know, there's no sort of shame in admitting what you know and making, you know, making sure you level up your skills before you can make use of this part kind of thing. So, and then it was originally being handled by my colleague Jeremy from France, who did a great job of just getting the kind of the general idea of a site set up and working out the kind of competitive analysis, you know, looking at the other beginners learning sites and seeing, you know, where we could fit in the arena. But then it got handed over to me and I worked out the list of tutorials and things I wanted to cover and then just set about writing them. And I'm also hoping to build up a community of people to help me get them written a bit quicker as well. So anybody that's interested, that's listening, I'd be glad of some help to write all this stuff.
Yeah, that sounds like a really great opportunity, because I think when people write, especially when they write about what they have just learned, it's such a great way to reinforce that knowledge. Right? Because you not only have to do it, because sometimes you can just kind of click things and hope it works out and not really understand it, but when you have to explain it to someone else and write a tutorial for someone else, it really deepens your own understanding.
Absolutely. You know, teaching is one of the best methods of learning. You know, you can sit there, can't you? And you can sort of go, well, I'm going to teach someone this pattern inside CSS that works pretty well. But then you sit there and think, well, I'm not exactly sure myself exactly why this works. I just know it works. And you have to sort of start digging through all of this arcane stuff inside W3C specs to fully understand exactly why that thing works like it does. You know, I mean, CSS is an interesting one anyway, because it's kind of, you know, it's not a proper programming language. It's sort of a strange language that some people love and some people really dislike. You know, I know a lot of JavaScript people that really, really dislike CSS just because it's not logical like a proper programming language, and some stuff works in quite a strange way. But you know, when you get used to writing that language, it's just like poetry kind of thing. I personally really enjoy CSS as a technology, but I could see why some of it could be a little bit tricky for complete beginners.
Yeah. So as a technical writer yourself, have you felt like you were developing your tech skills in a different way than if you were just coding?
Yeah, I think so. And I suppose it's interesting to also explore kind of the background of how technical writers come into technical writing, because some people come from the publishing, editing, writing end of the spectrum, and some people come to it from the coding end. And you tend to find that when you're coming to technical writing from the writing end of the spectrum, you know, you're going through and developing your skills as you go. So it's interesting at this point to examine kind of where technical writers come from in terms of where they started their journey and how they got into technical writing. So some come from the writing end of the spectrum and some come from the coding end of the spectrum, and these people all meet in the middle. So myself, I came from the writing end of the spectrum. You know, before I worked for browser vendors and W3C and eventually got to Mozilla, I worked for various publishing companies and started off by just editing books about various technologies. And for me, it really was, every day was kind of on the job training at learning the actual technologies, you know. So I was, and I haven't particularly had that much actual training in writing either. You know, it's just, I think there's a lot of people in our industry that sort of end up where they are kind of through no fault of their own, you know. But, you know, I seem like a pretty good fit for the job because I've always been good at expressing myself and writing, creative writing and writing of learning material as well. But, you know, every year or so, I kind of found myself understanding the tech a bit more. And that seemed to be really useful. So it was definitely a way for me to learn my skills. I think coming from the writing background, you kind of automatically tend to focus more on the aspects of the code that are more about communication. So things like making sure that the user experience of that demo that you've written kind of makes sense, making sure it's accessible, making sure the code comments are clear, you know, all of that kind of good stuff. Whereas when you come from technical writing from the programming side, I think your focus may be slightly different. It'll be more based on, you know, how can I show this example but code it in the most efficient way possible and all of that kind of stuff. I think that can be a little bit of a red herring anyway of technical writing. You know, like, you're not writing your code examples to be as efficient and clever as possible. You're writing them to make the code as understandable as possible. So sometimes, you know, a real proper hardcore coder might look at your example and go, why are you doing that like that? And you think to yourself, well, yeah, I'm doing it like that because doing it that way is far more understandable, whereas, you know, your way would just probably likely to confuse people. So that's always a consideration you have to make.
So how did you personally go from publishing and writing to technical writing?
So, I mean, my first job in publishing was as a trainee technical writer. So it was a relatively clear-cut path. When I first started, I edited all manner of books under the sun, from Windows technology books to XML and web services type stuff to Java stuff. And then we started off doing web standard stuff. It was I was with a company called Rocks Press at the time, and I was working there with Bruce Lawson of Opera fame. He's an old friend of mine. And we started up a publishing imprint together called Glasshouse, which was kind of one of the first publishing imprints to really solely focus on web standards-based technologies. And that imprint kind of died when Rocks went bankrupt. But, you know, by then the seeds had been sown, so I think we did a pretty good thing there. And then a lot of the other publishing companies started to really take note, and you know, you started to get tons of books about web standards, which was great, and tons of free online resources to learn the stuff as well. So that was cool. But then after a while, I kind of got a bit bored of technical publishing because, you know, it's okay, but I wanted to get a bit closer to the technology when I got more used to it. So I managed to get this job at Opera. I worked for Opera for 6 years before I came to Mozilla. And that was basically a job doing kind of technical evangelism stuff, as well as editing and publishing material on their dev.opera.com site. And again, that was really cool, and it got me much more involved in the whole web standards world, which, you know, I'm incredibly passionate about. And then after I'd been doing that for 6 years or so, it just sort of so happened out of the blue that pretty much out of the blue. I mean, it was when Opera made the decision to move from their own Presto rendering engine to the Blink rendering engine. And I don't know, I'm not going to go into a huge discussion about that, but I wasn't too happy with the decision.
Mm.
And then just around the same day, a friend of mine from Mozilla, Mihai Sukan, who's now no longer with us, unfortunately, contacted me and said, hey, you must hate the fact they've gone to Blink. Why don't you come to work for Mozilla? I was like, oh, I've not even thought about that. Am I good enough to work for Mozilla? And then the conversations happened, and, you know, long story short, I've ended up here. And I'm very happy I've ended up here, so it's cool. But yeah, you know, so I didn't really have like a particular path towards technical writing before that. I've always started off, you know, when I first started off, I was immediately in technical writing stuff. Before that, I did IT support stuff. And then before that, I did a degree in biochemistry. So it's nice. A bit random.
Huh, very interesting. So you've been in tech for a very, very long time. Have you ever thought about or wanted or planned to do just straight software development?
Not really, no. I think the part of tech that I really love is the training and education aspect. You know, the part that I really enjoy is especially, you know, teaching beginners and watching the little light bulbs come on over the top of people's heads. I love doing all that stuff. So I think really I'd like to stay in this area as long as possible.
So earlier you mentioned how Mozilla before you took over the learning area project, did competitive analysis on what type of tutorials existed, especially for beginners, and what that looked like. And I'm wondering, in that analysis, was there something that you or Mozilla saw missing? And if so, what was that thing?
So I'm not sure that everybody on the team exactly would agree with me, but I don't know. But I mean, my personal takeaway was that, you know, there's a lot of detailed tutorials all over the place, and there's lots of stuff that is written by universities and schools to support their own courses. There's a whole load of blog stuff around the place. You know, there's a lot of sites are still going strong with that kind of stuff. You know, stuff like CSS Tricks, you know, that stuff is still going really strong. But I kind of thought, well, to my mind, there's not really like a really obvious, like incredibly in-depth, detailed, all-encompassing beginner's tutorial set that could just be used as kind of a, hopefully a standard. You know, like one thing we want to do with this tutorial set is kind of promote it to schools and universities and try and get as many places using it as possible and as many places contributing back to it as possible. You know, just to make it sort of like, you know, a solid, trustworthy standard set of tutorials that you can use to learn the basic stuff. Because, you know, there's a whole bunch of good basic material around, but none of it's really organized into this sort of all-encompassing set of stuff. And, you know, other browser vendors have useful beginners learning stuff as well, but a lot of these kind of companies want to focus on the really cool, new, shiny, advanced toys. So I think it's nice that we can be doing something like that and sort of to give it kind of not only produce something really comprehensive, but also give it the kind of trustworthy Mozilla stamp.
Yeah, and I think that to do something like that where it's a standard, right? It's not just another beginner tutorial. It's one that is approved or at least used by colleges, universities, and other organizations. You have to constantly incorporate feedback, right? And you have to kind of be very humble and, you know, be open to criticism and make sure that what you're doing really does meet the needs of beginners. And so how do you capture that feedback? How do you make sure that what you think is working really is working?
So we haven't done so much of the feedback yet. I mean, what I wanted to do is get a bunch of these learning modules written first, just so I have a good solid set of stuff to give out to people. But very soon, I'm going to start sending it out to a whole bunch of places. So for example, the Tech Evangelism team at Mozilla have been doing a whole load of outreach to various code schools, you know, like private institutions that do tech learning, to see what kind of stuff they want and what kind of stuff we could do to be useful to them. I've also got a lot of contacts at various universities and colleges around the world. You know, I used to do a lot of university tours and things of Opera. So I do know a lot of people at universities, and I'm just going to start sending the stuff out to all of the lecturers that I know and asking them, you know, how that stuff could help them. You know, how could we make it any easier to fit into their courses? You know, because one thing that we try to stick with the learning area is the idea that we want to just produce a bunch of tutorials that can be used and chopped up and pretty much fitted into any curriculum structure that you want, kind of thing. Because if you're too prescriptive about it and you offer like a set in stone curriculum structure with all of the assessments and all that kind of stuff, then it's not quite as useful to as many people, because other people are going to say, well, hey, you know, that's great, but I can't fit that into my curriculum structure over here. So that's one thing we've tried to be pretty mindful of, you know, just making the tutorials comprehensive, but still quite vanilla in terms of how they stack together kind of thing. And we have got some assessments as well on the learning area, but they're not intended to be stuff that you have to use. They're more intended to be kind of suggested assessments. So yeah, and we've got that stuff. So we're gonna do all that. And then the other thing that I want to do as well is basically just find a bunch of beginners and get them to start working through the material and come and tell me what's confusing and what's great. That's always very useful as well. We haven't got a huge amount of money to throw around for a really, really formalized testing and feedback procedure, but you know, I'm all for kind of the sort of guerrilla testing kind of methodology anyway. So
oh yeah. Just grab a couple people.
Yep.
Buy them a latte and ask them for feedback.
My kids are going to feature heavily in the the testing guinea pigs, I think.
Very nice. So one thing that I find really incredible is the fact that you have been a writer for a very long time. You've been in tech for a very long time, but you are still able to remember what the beginner mindset is like. And I think it's really hard. You know, the more that you know, the more that you've experienced, the more you have under your belt, it becomes harder to remember what it's like to feel very confused about something as simple to you as the A tag, right? So how do you remind yourself? How do you keep yourself in that beginner mindset as you, you know, get more and more years of experience?
I suppose it definitely comes with experience. You know, I've been writing beginner's material for so long that I kind of just naturally, intuitively get how to write that stuff now. Just, you know, I've been doing this stuff for about 16 years now. So it's, it's been a long time writing that kind of style of material. The other thing that I do is I try and, again, sort of, I could be in danger of talking about my kids far too much again, which I quite often do, but you know, having children really helps, because children have very young, malleable minds, and they're always trying to learn new things, and they're always failing at learning things, at least for a while. So having children around is a very useful thing to sort of keep yourself in that basic beginner mindset with things. And then also, I always try and continually learn something new all the time as well. I deliberately set myself like a project to learn all the time. For example, at the moment, I'm trying to learn Mozilla's Rust language, which is this new low-level systems programming language that we have, which we're writing the next generation of browsers inside. So that's going to be interesting stuff to see where that goes. But, you know, and that's quite a new kind of language for me to learn, because I'm very used to web-style technologies, but I'm not used to kind of lower-level type languages. So I'm deliberately kind of, you know, going outside my comfort zone and trying to learn something difficult to me. But that also helps me to keep in the mindset of a beginner. You know, it's almost kind of like, it's kind of like try and make yourself feel stupid at least once a day, you know, just so you can remember it. And that's what it feels like sometimes.
So my last question for you is advice. I want to hear what advice you have for people who might have a very strong writing background, maybe not a strong technical background, but a strong writing background. They've, you know, either been editors or have a personal blog and are very comfortable with that medium, and who are trying to transition into a coding career and maybe hadn't heard of a technical writer before. What advice do you have for people who might be interested in the type of work that you do, and how can they get started learning more about it and exploring it further?
So I suppose the best way to start out is definitely to do some background research and get some experience of just writing and learning new coding stuff. You know, like one idea that I love that I've seen quite a few universities do is, you know, all of their undergrad students on their technical stroke web stroke whatever courses, they get them to set up a blog and they get them to write about all of the stuff that they learn, and constantly get being set bits of homework, you know, write a blog post about framework X and how it and the basics of it and things like that. I think that's quite cool, you know, to constantly challenge people to practice their communication skills and improve on their communication skills, you know, because really, you know, it's all about communication, and whether you're whether you're a technical writer or whether you're a pure developer or whether you're a designer or a UX person or whatever, you know, there's none of these related disciplines in which communication is not important, really. So, you know, I think it's important just to give yourself a project to constantly teach and improve your writing and communication skills, such as have your own blog, constantly write about stuff. I think when you've moved on from there a bit, then it's useful to start maybe trying to get some paid work, perhaps writing on stuff like on publications like A List Apart or Smashing Magazine. And talk to people online. You know, there's a really great conference called Write the Docs, which is all basically a conference for technical writers. And there's one in North America, there's one in Europe each year. So if you can get along to one of those and talk to like-minded people, and also just search for people on social media like Twitter and just follow a few people and see what kind of stuff they get up to. Because it's an interesting one. You know, again, technical writing, just like most of the web industry, there's not particularly much in the way of formalized learning processes to get into this kind of stuff. I think most of us kind of fell into it by accident. But yeah, just sort of keep exploring it and keep practicing your writing. You can also go to companies like Mozilla and Google and try and get freelance work. In fact, I do know a lot of technical writers that work purely on a freelance basis, because you get big companies like Mozilla and Google who have the scope to need full-time technical writers, but then you also have a lot of smaller companies that kind of, you know, need technical writing, but they probably don't need a full-time job. They might need like a day a week's work done on this kind of stuff. So that kind of work gets handed out to freelance technical writers a lot of the time. But yeah, I think that, you know, keep talking to people, networking, finding industry contacts on social media. You know, stuff like Twitter is a great way to start talking to new people without needing big scary introductions or anything. And most of us are more than happy to talk to people and offer advice, because, again, that sort of side of things is all about communication too.
Definitely. And you also offered an opportunity to write for Mozilla as well, right? Yep. For those introductory tutorials. So there's your opportunity to get involved and get started.
Absolutely.
So next, let's move on to some fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Okay, yeah, I'm ready to go.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
So the worst advice I think I've ever received is to follow a career path defined by my grades at school rather than what I'm passionate about. You know, so I mentioned earlier that I did a 3-year degree in biochemistry, and I found most of it pretty boring and not very useful and not very interesting and not very exciting. And, you know, I wouldn't say I nearly quit, but I certainly thought about it at one point. So I was just like, why am I doing this? You know, just because I got good science grades at school didn't mean that was the kind of thing that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So, you know, it took me a little while to get back on the right path, as it were. You know, it was like the last year of my degree involved a bunch of bioinformatics stuff. So bioinformatics is basically the study of proteins and molecules and other chemical stuff using computers. It's just a general term for it. And that kind of stuff was interesting. And that kind of stuff got me interested in not only computers, but also the World Wide Web, very fledgling as it was back then. So, you know, I eventually got back there, but it did take a while. You know, I think if I'd have done computer science instead at university, it would have probably been a lot more useful in terms of my programming skills, but perhaps not necessarily useful to web design, because there's this sort of divide at universities between the design people and the hardcore programming people, and web design and web development don't really necessarily fit very well anywhere, because, you know, it's kind of a total orphan thing, because the computer science kids will look at it and go, well, that's not proper programming. And then the design people will look at it and go, that's really scary because it's got code in it. So it kind of sits somewhere in the middle, not really knowing where it wants to live. Most of the best web design and web development courses I know are sitting inside slightly strange schools, such as business schools or journalism schools, you know, kind of
really
places where I'm not talking about everything around the world. I'm talking about sort of you know, courses that I personally know the lecturers involved in and things. You know, you have these awesome little courses on basic web development stuck inside business schools or journalism schools, just because it's like stuff that's tangentially related. You know, yeah. People in those sort of areas are going to want to, are going to have to come in contact with the web at some point and possibly do
especially
some...
Especially the digital.
Yeah, absolutely.
The journalism one, particularly.
Absolutely, yeah. But so that's kind of an interesting little thing as well. And, you know, the other thing I could have done at university would perhaps have been music, because I've always been really into music, played drums. I've played in many, many bands over the years. You know, so that would have been cool to do at university as well. Not sure how that would have been for my career, but hey. But yeah, I think ultimately the short version of the advice is, you know, always try and follow your passion rather than the thing that you think is going to look good on paper, kind of thing.
Good advice. I like that. Number two, my first coding project was about?
So the first coding project I can really remember that was kind of like a proper app or fun little project was, it was back when I first started to learn JavaScript, which was probably only about maybe 6 years ago now. So I haven't been doing JavaScript for a huge amount of time compared to the time I've been doing HTML and CSS and other related bits. But I started out learning JavaScript by asking my friends and my children what kind of apps they'd like to have and just going off and then trying to code those apps. And one of the first things that my son said way back when was he'd like to have a Harry Potter quiz app. You know, and this was kind of, you know, way back when he was really obsessed by Harry Potter. And
I might like a Harry Potter quiz app.
Yeah, well, I can send you the URL. Nice. But yeah, so I coded that, and just, you know, it was a useful little app because it taught me a bunch of DOM manipulation stuff, and it was also useful for learning how to read data out of JSON and put it in an app and all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, I posted it up to GitHub a little bit later. So, but yeah, it's available on my GitHub, which is Chris David Mills. So it was really fun to code.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
So for this, I would say probably some proper programming theory. Because, you know, when you say code there, I'm kind of thinking about proper code like JavaScript or other proper languages rather than, you know, things like HTML and CSS. Because there's quite a few occasions, you know, I'm completely self-taught and obviously very biased towards the website of things. But there's often times when I'm sitting there reading some kind of tutorial or something and learning some new thing, and I'll get presented with some kind of programming jargon and I just won't have a clue what it is. And then I'll go and look it up and I'll think, oh, that's what it means. And it's probably like ludicrously, pathetically basic for like a computer science student. So that's kind of one thing I would like to have more of a handle on.
Do you think that being self-taught, you can still get that type of foundational programming theory?
Oh, totally, yeah. I really think you do. But I think this is one of those issues, isn't it? It's kind of a case of you can always think back on how you learnt something and think with hindsight, oh, I could have learnt that so much more effectively if I'd just done this. So maybe the answer is no. It's hard to tell, really, isn't it? Thinking back, you know, when you or I first learnt to code. When you first learnt to code, you basically just learn by necessity. You learn by going, I really need to solve this problem, or I'd really like to be able to do this. So how do I hack my way through to it in the least amount of time possible? And that was especially what it felt like for a lot of the stuff when I first started to learn JavaScript, especially. You know, you don't immediately think to yourself, oh, I'd better go and learn all of the really proper official theory for all this stuff. You think to yourself, I just want to hack some stuff together that looks fun. So maybe the answer's no. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think it's something that a lot of people listening probably struggle with as well, where being self-taught, and even if you're not self-taught, even if you were in a boot camp or an online boot camp or something a little bit more formal, the focus is still very much on applicable skills, right? So it's what can you build? What can you do right now? And a lot of that foundational computer science-y stuff doesn't really have much priority.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, and it, you know, again, it doesn't really necessarily make for a very effective, copable learning strategy. It's like, for example, I remember there's some pretty good JavaScript learning resources available now, but back, say, sort of, you know, I think I first tried to learn JavaScript maybe about 10 years ago, and I can remember having a terrible time and feeling that a lot of the books available back in those days were pretty terrible for learning because they would either assume far too much knowledge and not have considered the target audience properly, or they would go, okay, let's learn JavaScript properly. Here's 70 pages of theory before you even write your first variable. And it's a bit like, yeah, that's the terrible way to learn anything. It's like, you need to jump in with something easy and interesting that inflames your passion for it before you start trying to go down that route.
Yeah. So next, let's do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
Okay, so I'd really like to give a shout out to Chad Sansing from the Mozilla Foundation. He's kind of like my main man over on the Mozilla Foundation, who does a lot of their curriculum development stuff. So one kind of way that we're working together between the Mozilla Corporation and Mozilla Foundation is the idea that in the learning area over on the corporation side, I can write all of these hopefully excellent tutorials that we've discussed. Whereas over on the foundation side, they do a lot of sort of much more prescriptive work towards education, like actual proper curriculum structures. And for example, they have a great site called it's teach.mozilla.org. And that contains a bunch of really nice teaching activities. And it also contains a really cool thing called the Web Literacy Map, which is more of a tool for educators than learners. But that's basically like a high-level framework which details all of the different atomic skills you ought to know to have to achieve web literacy. So there's some really, really cool tools there for both learners and teachers alike. But with all of the learning activities that they're publishing and all of the different workshops and things they're running, I'm hopefully going to provide them with, you know, links to my material to cover all of the stuff in a bit more detail and provide the actual full learning experience kind of thing. So that's cool.
Nice. And now for a few personal shout outs. One is The Most Important Question of Your Life. That's the name of it. It's a blog post by Mark Manson. Have you heard of this before, Chris?
No.
It came out a few years ago, and I read it back then, and I thought, wow, this is really great. I'm never going to forget this. And then someone tweeted it maybe a few weeks ago, and I read it again. I was like, wow, this is really great. I'm never going to forget this. So I'm going to put this on the podcast so that I never actually forget it. It is a really, really great, very insightful blog post that says that the most important question that you should ask is not about what makes you happy, but instead, what are you willing to struggle for? And the way that the blog post discusses it is that, you know, everyone wants to be happy. Everyone wants to feel fulfilled, and everyone wants to have a great, satisfying life. But if that requires a certain level of pain and struggle and work, you may not want that specific goal as much as you thought you did. And so instead of focusing on, you know, what is your passion and what is the thing that gets you excited, focusing your effort on finding out what is the thing that if you had to, you know, cry and be very upset and frustrated over for a long time, but then you got it, would it still be worth it to you? What are you willing to really, you know, go through lots of trials and tribulations for? And I thought that was such a great way to look at things. It gave me just a lot of perspective. So I encourage you all to do the same.
I really like the idea of this blog post. You know, it's again, it's something that I come across with my children all the time. It's a very common topic amongst parents, the idea of, you know, getting children to really, really try hard with stuff like learning to code or learning a musical instrument. Things that, you know, to start off with seem as if they have zero return, and a lot of children just give up in frustration in a matter of weeks, because, you know, learning something like the piano or JavaScript or anything difficult requires a huge mental outlay before you get any return whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just difficult for children to cope with, it's difficult for anybody to cope with. So I really like the idea of considering that.
Yeah, me too. I thought it was really smart. The next one that I have is called Writing Great Documentation, which felt very relevant for this conversation. And it is another blog post written by Taylor Singletary. I'm hoping I'm saying that correctly. And Taylor is a very big technical writer, writes lots of documentation, and has done so for lots of big companies. And so he wrote out kind of bullet points of things that are very important to writing good documentation. So one is always telling a story, making sure that readers are engaged with a positive character, ideally, in the story, and kind of having something to follow and a journey to follow along. Second is having an active voice and actionable content, which I really like, because a lot of times I'll read a blog post and I'll think, okay, so now what do I do, right? And when I was looking at the introduction to HTML that you sent over, Chris, one of the things that I really appreciated is at the very bottom, the last section it has is called assessment. And so immediately it says, you know, you read this thing, you look at the samples, you get what's going on, but let's really see if you know what to do. Try this out. And I really like just that specific, explicit action item that I can now take.
Oh, cool. Well, I'm glad you appreciated that. I mean, those are very good sound bits of advice. That sounds like another great post to read, especially if you're looking to get more into the technical writing world, as we were discussing earlier on.
Definitely, yeah. And he has a couple more, too. I won't regurgitate the blog post on the podcast, but it has lots of just really good ideas on how to get started and what are best practices. So if you're interested, I highly recommend that blog post. So take a read and let us know what you think. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our online forum for people excited about code. Or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for #CodeNewbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes on this episode at codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Chris, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
I certainly would. I really wish I didn't have to, but I guess it's time for us to go. Goodbye all. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.